And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Just the other day, I commented to someone that at least the hurricane season was over. Wrong. Hurricane Wilma is on its way into the Gulf Coast with projections for landfall in Florida. Wilma is the biggest so far. It's like someone is trying to give us no excuse whatsoever to ignore the warnings. Will anyone benefit from this? Actually, in today's show, we will announce a real opportunity for you to win $3,000 if you put together the best answer. There is a little catch, and you'll find out what that is when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's a lot of hard work being in the news business. I had this great show planned that was going to take our minds off the disasters sweeping around the world, and then out of the blue water of the Atlantic, Hurricane Wilma materializes. It's true, no one can prove that global climate change is actually happening because climates change by their very nature. Global warming is now a term that no one wants to hear about because the debate is as challenging as the apparent results. But below all the brouhaha are some of the facts that science cannot debate. CO2 is increasing in our atmosphere. We have had three of the hottest years on record in the last four, and we just set a record for most hurricanes in a single season. And so, today, we accept the hard-edged truth that such is the state of the world, and give ourselves a little break. I'm sure that's okay with most of you. So during our first segment, following the news, we're going to check in at two national parks to hear how the animals are adapting to the changes, actually the natural changes, that happen this time each year as winter approaches. So it's up to the Badlands of South Dakota, then down to the ancient dwellings of Chaco. Now here's something fun. Challenging, and if done right, could really help turn our country around, but most important to you, do it right, and you've got a $3,000 bill in your pocket. That's absolutely true. We helped to launch a great idea sponsored by EI2025.org, which is holding an audition for songwriters to write the best tune for tuning up our energy future. It's open to anyone, and that includes you. And then, in segment three, I'm demanding that each of you do exactly what I say, because it will get you so in touch with things that matter. And it's so easy, and this is the time to do it. I'm conducting my fourth on-air art class to get you to take a walk, take a look at your changing world, choose some leaves, and learn to draw them. Now don't cop out on me, stick with me on this one. You'll be glad you did. So we best throttle up and get on to the news, and then on with the show. So first, the news. In a recent Harris poll sponsored by the Wall Street Journal, Americans overwhelmingly agree that protecting the environment is important and standards cannot be too high. Nearly three-quarters of U.S. adults surveyed supported strict protections. The same poll concludes that 71% of those responsible for environmental problems are large corporations, while at the same time, 63% said the general public is not doing its share. Water pollution topped the list of concerns, with air pollution and global warming next in rank. The survey also concluded that 42% of Americans feel that environmental groups are doing more than their share, while 44% said the media was doing less than their share. And while only 12% of respondents classified themselves as environmentalists, 58% said they were sympathetic to environmental concerns. The Senate Energy Committee voted Wednesday to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska to oil drilling as part of a broad budget bill to help fund the federal government. In an end-around move, the energy panel agreed to attach the ANWR drilling provision to the budget bill because it cannot be filibustered. The provision was passed 13-9, with all Republicans and two Democrats, Mary Landrieu and Daniel Akaka, voting in favor of the bill. Democratic leaders are expected to raise objections to the bill's provisions. Although the bill authorizes no more than 2,000 acres of land usage in the ANWR area, the impact can be very widespread as pipelines can form a matrix extending for many miles while taking up little land. The bill, which has been touted as a means to help the U.S. meet its oil and energy needs, amazingly includes a provision which permits selling of Alaskan oil to China or other foreign nations. Democrat Ron Wyden introduced a proposal to ban such transshipment, but his proposal was defeated. The Senate is expected to debate the budget bill next week and vote on the bill the following week. Last week, the Wildside News reported on the policy changes, which were written by Assistant Deputy Interior Secretary Paul Hoffman, that promoted widespread increases in motorized vehicles such as snowmobiles and all-terrain vehicles on public lands. However, after review, the National Park Service has backed off of the Hoffman changes, releasing a draft proposal which maintains and protects more of the historic intent of protecting national parks in a relatively pristine condition. The Hoffman proposal would have expanded the use of snowmobiles and all-terrain vehicles on federal lands, and it proposed that in order for activities to be prohibited in parks, they must be something that irreversibly harms the parks instead of only harming them. Park Service officials said the new drafts would leave current snowmobile and off-road regulations in place, and the word irreversibly has been removed. The new policy will be reviewed by the Senate Energy Subcommittee on National Parks November 1st. In an aggressive push by the Bush administration to open more public land to oil and gas production, the Interior Department has quit conducting environmental reviews and seeking comments from local residents every time drilling companies propose new wells. These relaxed permitting restrictions will apply to BLM lands close to existing projects, which are less than 150 acres and no more than 5 acres in any one spot where nearby drilling has occurred in the past 5 years. The new policies will streamline the permitting of hundreds of new geothermal, gas, and oil wells and are targeted for quick implementation on open ranges and the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, specifically the Powder River Basin of Wyoming, the Uinta Basin of Utah, the San Juan Basin of New Mexico, and areas adjacent to Colorado's Ancients National Monument. Meanwhile, new reports from Europe and now Russia indicate that the bird flu is spreading quickly. And as we speak, yet another major hurricane, perhaps the largest on record, in the Atlantic, pokes its swirling chaos into the Gulf of Mexico again. And that's the news. And a few reminders. We've got a whole lot of new listeners. Now, if you want to receive our weekly email that gives you a heads up on what the upcoming show is about, I want you to send me an email at wildsidenews@cox.net and let me know you want to get the weekly update. That's wildsidenews@cox.net, wildsidenews@cox.net. And feel free to tell me a little bit about you, what you'd like to hear, some story ideas. I love to hear from my listeners. Now, we've got a great show. Change. It's being forced upon us at such rapid speed it sometimes is hard to adapt. Well, in the wild creatures are having to adapt to the changes that the seasons bring. And I talked with a couple of national park folks about what they're noticing from the field. We begin in Badlands National Park in South Dakota, then head on down to one of my favorite parks, what many refer to as Chaco Canyon.
My name is Aaron Kay. I'm a park ranger at Badlands National Park in South Dakota. And, observations that I see throughout the course of the year, especially from summer into winter, I think most noticeable would first be bird life. And, of course, migrant birds that you begin to see moving through, coming from the north, heading south. spending nights over on some of the stock dams throughout the area, not just in the park, but outside of the park. Noticing the disappearance of many of the songbirds, turkey vultures leaving for the season and heading south. The reduction in the bat population as they migrate out of the area. And some distinctive species that in the avian aspect that you might see changing here through the season would be all the migrant waterfowl, but one most remarkable would be the sandhill cranes. And usually sometime around mid-October we'll see them flying across the sky, wheeling through the air, trying to gain altitude and hear their chortling as they pass us by, and it's a sign of winter soon to come. Other things we notice in the park include, of course, the changing of the coats with the animals, going from a thinner winter coat to a thicker, or a thinner summer coat to a winter coat that's a little bit thicker. Animals will often move from summer areas into winter areas. Bighorn sheep tend to rut in the early winter, and we begin to see them across from the visitor center in one of their main rutting areas starting sometime in mid to late October. Populations like the bison in the park, of course, their coats increase in thickness. You see the calves change from their orange color as newborn calves into a more brownish color as the winter turns. And in addition to that, of course, you see the antlers growing on the bucks in the rutting season for the deer, both the whitetail and the mule deer.
Just curious, too, in terms of sort of movements and behaviors, the summer is kind of a lazy time, and different animals are able to find food probably more easily. Just curious if you're observing any sort of changes in as food sources become more scarce.
Well, you know, that's actually a good question. You know, what you don't really see a lot of movement in that sense other than maybe particular food sources that are still green. So you'll see animals gravitating to areas you know, like riparian areas or wetland areas along creek drainages, maybe into some of the river valleys in the area. And some of the last green grass in the area typically is along the sides of the roads. So one of the things that we see an increase of around here at this time of the year is deer commonly along the sides of the road into the evening. And unfortunately outside of the park, probably one of the number one roadkill that we begin to see in the fall into the winter are deer, and it's often because they're feeding on that still green grass along the edges of the road.
You mentioned that bats are migrating. How do you observe that?
Well, we don't really see the bats migrate. What we notice, of course, is, you know, under every light here in the housing area and around the park, you know, during the summer months, you'll see the insects, and you know, spinning underneath the light, and you'll see bats weaving in and out of that light shaft, picking up bugs. And of course, as fall comes into play, you see less and less of those critters. And about this time of the year, we're really only seeing just occasional bats anymore. I don't see many under the lights, but on a regular night, you might see as many as a half a dozen at each light, just kind of swooping in and out of it, going after moths and other insects.
And how is your the weather shaping up at this point in the season?
Well, this year, you know, we had a pretty good moisture. We've been in a drought for a number of years. This year we had good moisture in the spring, and that kind of carried through the summer. What we're seeing as far as temperatures is kind of an extension of Indian summer. We're at a low 80s today here in the Badlands, and that's kind of warm even for October. Conditions have been relatively dry. We have had no real hard freezes as of yet, so the colors that are slowly changing on some of the deciduous trees is slower than usual. Some years you'll see it happen right after a hard frost, and this year without that, we've just kind of seen a slow trend to the color of yellow and leaves slowly kind of drifting off the trees around the park.
Now that's kind of unusual for your area, isn't it?
Usually we get some sort of cold snap that comes through and kind of tends to really kick things into gear, getting, you know, of course, plants and animals ready for winter. But this year, the two big storms passed to the north and the south of us. Colorado got a pretty good storm about 2 weeks ago, and North Dakota got a pretty good storm more like 3 weeks ago. And we just got a little bit of rain out of it and no hard freeze. So it's a little unusual. We get temperature mood swings from as much as 50 below in the winter to 116 in the summer. And fall and spring are really nice times of the year because the temperatures are pretty moderate.
Now, are you open all year round?
Yep, we're open all year round. Scenic Loop Road in the park is about 30 miles long. It includes beautiful scenery, the park, the Badlands formations, as well as the wildlife, and a trip out onto Sage Creek Rim Road, which is a gravel road which skirts the north boundary of the wilderness area, provides views of the wilderness area, and also our bison herd, which is about almost 1,000 strong.
It's a great, amazing, rugged park that is it's appropriately called the Badlands.
That's correct. You know, Badlands are found in other places in the world. It's a geologic term, but the type site for the geologic term is right here in Badlands National Park in South Dakota.
Thanks so much for adding your voice to the Wild Side News.
You bet. My pleasure.
We continue our journey around America to see what's happening with the wild creatures, and we're focusing on national parks today. And so joining us from one of my all-time most favorite national parks in the entire universe is Brad Shattuck, who's the Chief of Natural Resources at Chaco Culture National Historical Park, one of the most amazing places in the world. Brad, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Oh, thank you. Thrilled to be here. Thanks.
First of all, give me a sense of what's happening down there in the Southwest.
In the Southwest in the fall, it's really a wonderful dynamic period, meaning it's changing quite a bit with the fall season as it approaches. You have birds starting to leave the canyon. The flora begins to turn yellow and brown and red. You have rainstorms that occur generally at least a number of times during the week at this time of year. And you can start to feel a bit of the frostbite as winter begins its slow but steady onset.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit more about those details, but let's talk a little bit about Chaco Canyon itself, which is such an amazing place and so important in American history, and actually in Mesoamerican history. Anyone who visits Chaco will be overwhelmed by its story. Give us a brief version of that.
Oh, certainly. Well, first, let me tell you where we're located, and we're a rather large park at 34,000 acres. And we're located in a very remote corner of northwest New Mexico. In fact, it's one of the only parks in the lower 48 that I know of that's entrance road is still unpaved. It's a bumpy ride in, and you get a wilderness experience once you arrive. However, once you're here, you're going to open up into essentially what is known as New York of 1,000 years ago. Mm. This is New York City. This is where this place was hopping 1,000 years ago. What we refer to as the Chacoan culture people. These people, who are essentially the ancestors of today's American Pueblo people, built these massive, huge, massive ruins, one of which covers 8 acres in size, known as Pueblo Bonito. They lived here for approximately 300 years before eventually moving on. And in some cases, the preservation of these buildings ranges from remarkable to, well, the building looks like 1,000 years old. So when you come out here, you're going to be overawed by the wilderness experience and your ability to tour these buildings on your own and at your own pace, or with a ranger guided tour if you want.
I've been out to Chaco many times. I actually spent one night stuck on the road following a rainstorm on my attempts to get out there because it turned into caliche, and then I was stuck and couldn't move. It's a relatively isolated, but it's a deep canyon followed surrounded by bluffs, and I share with you so much that vision of this place being a very metropolitan zone at that time. I oftentimes, as I've, for example, been on top of one of the bluffs, and there's an area that feels like it's like a little water pool, and I've often imagined people in the moonlight being up there, sort of lounging around in a water bath, and then just walking around that beautiful place. There's how many different structures?
The massive Great House ruins. How many are there?
Yes. Uh huh.
Okay. The Great House ruins that at least you can visit. There are 14. Total of the largest great house sites. Now, Chaco Canyon, though, if you had that figure in your head, would be a little misleading, because there are over 4,000 archaeological sites located in Chaco Canyon.
Right.
And in some cases, when they did these site surveys, it was fairly arbitrary in what they were calling the site. So defining the boundaries of the site is sometimes the problem, because these buildings are so large and encompass such a large area, where one site starts and one site stops is sometimes a little bit of an issue.
There are many features that are so extraordinary and powerful in Chaco. Pueblo Bonito, which is, I believe, the largest structure there, is it right? It had about 800 rooms at one time?
Yeah, 800 is about right for Pueblo Bonito. The problem with Pueblo Bonito is it covers such a massive area, and the archaeologists about 20 years ago had discovered another large foundation that may in fact link both Chetroquetl and Pueblo Bonito together.
Mm.
So calling it Pueblo Bonito, what we call today Pueblo Bonito, can be a little bit misleading, because it's huge, and we really don't know the entire extent of this building.
The stonework as well tells a story.
Oh, sure, absolutely. Each individual block themselves, you can be rest assured, was shaped by human hands. 1,000 years ago, envision in your mind somebody taking another rock against the sandstone, chipping it at right angles, at very precise right angles, and then filling a wall that stretches 4 stories over top of your head. And it truly looks marvelous, like an artist's painting, or truly some of the finest masonry that you'll see in America today, where these people painstakingly glued these sandstone blocks together with mud mortar to make a facade of amazing stonework that's just monumental in scale.
How many people have been estimated to have lived there at its peak?
At its peak, you have, and this is one of the key areas of debate and research today, some people will say as many as 4,000 people lived in this canyon and built these buildings. Other people, based upon the environment and what you could grow here, suggest only roughly 400 to 500 people lived inside the canyon. Either case, they did something in this canyon that has never been replicated before or since.
It was quite a bit of a cultural trade center, sort of tying what I would believe the southern Mesoamerican communities up into the Pueblo cultures and the southwestern Pueblo cultures. Talk about some of the things that you found there that indicate the extent of that trade.
Well, the extent of the trade itself, you can see in the types of artifacts that were excavated out of some of the Great House ruins. You have a number of shells that come from the Gulf and Baja of California coasts. You have parrots, actually the physical bird, being transported all the way from Chihuahua and Sonoran. A great example of that is the blue and gold macaw coming from Sonora, Mexico. In some cases, you even have the scarlet macaw. A couple of skeletons were found inside of Pueblo Bonito. And the scarlet macaw comes from the Yucatan Peninsula of present-day Mexico.
And then, of course, there's a most unique feature, which is the sun dagger, which until relatively recently wasn't known about. But let's talk a little bit about the sun dagger.
Oh, certainly. The sun dagger is an archaeoastronomical marker first discovered by Anna Sofer as part of the Chaco Project. And the Chaco Project was an intense research period of field schools designed to really study the archaeology here in the canyon and really kind of determine what we have in Chaco. As part of this survey, they discovered the sun dagger, which consists of 3 large upright sandstone blocks, and the lighting of that would be of the sun, which shine through these blocks in such manner as to form a dagger of light. And this dagger of light pierces a spiral that was carved on the rock face 1,000 years ago that directly corresponds with the winter solstice and the summer solstice, as well as the equinoxes. So they, in effect, had a virtual calendar. And now we think of a calendar as something as, commonplace and everyday, but think of 1,000 years ago, living in the San Juan Basin of New Mexico, where you only have 120 days for growing your corn and providing food for your family. Having that precise measurement of when is the best time to plant your crops is absolutely critical to ensure the well-being of your family.
Right, the equinox point in that calendar would be the point at which the days began to lengthen. It's the change point, which is something that naturally inspires plants to grow. as a matter of fact, and flour. And then also there's quite a bit of speculation as to why they left. Why don't you tell us when they left? And there's a lot of theories.
There's a number of theories, more than we could ever get into. But as a whole, these people did not disappear. That's a common misnomer and a myth. The people exist today in Hopi, Acoma, Zuni, all the Pueblos along the Rio Grande River are descendant from the Chacon people. The reasons why they left, some claim that it was a massive drought. We know from tree ring dates that there was a 76-year period of intense drought. Also, because the plants are so respondent upon when it rains, the timing of that rainfall during that drought may have also forced them to move on to more perennial sources of water. Out here in the semi-arid southwest in the San Juan Basin, water is certainly the most precious commodity. If you don't have water, you can't live in this location. And without access to a readily supplyable source of water, these people would have to move on.
As we experience ourselves some what appear to be climatic changes due to potentially global warming, I certainly believe that that is the case. When we think about a 76-year drought, 76 years, we can see the stresses that that could create for a culture that is self-surviving.
Oh, certainly. You'd have to move. At 76 years, I'd be willing to say that not a single person lived to be 76 years old 1,000 years ago. So you're really talking about potentially three, maybe even four generations of people in that 76-year period. Undoubtedly, they would have to move or at least radically change their cultures to adapt to the changing environment.
Well, now let's kind of bring this to the point of all of this, and that is to say now as we look at the fall, and there are changes, and that obviously the changes that the animals, which I'd like to talk about, are going to have to experience as winter sets in, were also shared by the humans there, and I'm sure there were very similar considerations. So let's talk now about what you're noticing in terms of the changes that animals are having to make at this time of year, which is a time of change.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, 2 days ago, I was hiking out on the west boundary of Chaco near an archaeological site, and they came across three or four prairie rattlesnakes that were searching and looking for their hibernacula or their winter den. Typically, these types of reptiles you'll only see at the hottest point of the day at this time of year, around 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And then they'll get underground so that they can stay warm. So they'll only be out for a short time. Other changes, a week ago, I was able to watch the departure of our turkey vultures that occur here in the canyon. We have a resident population of 14 to 15 individuals. That count is debated. And they started out by floating the thermals, or these air, rising air currents, higher and higher and higher until they were literally points of black against this brilliant blue sky of Chaco. And then as one, they headed off to the south. And they probably won't return until March of this next spring. Other changes, our migrants are starting to leave from the northern Colorado Rocky Mountains, and as they descend through New Mexico, sometimes they stop over in Chaco for a couple of days before they head on farther south. And I'm referring to birds like the grosbeaks and some of the mountain blues as they head back to their winter range here in Chaco. So it's a real exciting time.
How about coyotes and rabbits and noticing any changes amongst them? That may be pretty standard, but for example, cover starts to change for rabbits.
Well, certainly. Rabbits themselves, you'll see as the leaves fall off a lot of the shrubs, essentially their habitat cover from being preyed from raptors, they'll hide and cower underneath a lot of these bushes, certainly during the day, and you'll see them a little more active towards the evening hours as the light gets lower and lower in the sky. Their behavior isn't dramatically different from that of the summer, but they are more restricted in terms of where they can go from bush to bush. I saw a real interesting interaction with a coyote and a badger 4 days ago in the center of the park. This badger was following a coyote, and because that piqued my interest, I thought they were potentially in a fight, but it turns out they were in form of symbiosis, or a good positive relationship, where they would help each other dig out various bugs out of the ground, and then they would share these bugs. It was really interesting observation.
That's a great story. I like that. That's amazing. Was the badger kind of tracking along?
I thought they were in a fight. I thought the coyote pretty much ticked off the badger.
Well, that's easy to do.
And the badger was chasing, what I thought at first was chasing the coyote. But as they approached the top of the talus and they lost interest in me, I saw that they were digging around a lot of the bases of these greasewood plants and some of the saltbrush plants. And sure enough, as I went up there later after they left the area, I saw that they were both taking turns digging out the hole and then grabbing some of the bugs, and they didn't get them all. I did see some more down in the bottom of the hole.
It
was really interesting stuff.
How about cougars and bears?
Cougars and bears in Chaco Canyon are very, very rare. Occasionally they'll come through, but only under extreme duress or distress. Bears, in the case of a fire like we had in the Jemez Mountains a little more than 3 or 4 years ago, we had a few bears come through. We occasionally will have a mountain lion, but mostly in Chaco Canyon we have bobcat, resident population of bobcat.
Also, yeah, you have a lot of little ground squirrels of various sorts there. Are they caching things away?
Absolutely. At this time of year, everyone's active. At least all the animals are. Certainly the smaller mammals, the pack rats, the ground squirrels, are going out and grabbing as many sources of food as they can to store for the long winter. That's nothing unusual. You can find that anywhere across the United States this time of year.
So tell me what you think, and I'll let you speculate. I know you're not supposed to too much because you must maintain your scientific objectivity. But I welcome the opportunity to hear what you think about when you think about this time of year and the people of the Chaco culture and what they may have been considering or thinking about or doing at this time of year when the Chaco culture was thriving.
1,000 years ago, I can envision in my head and truly speculate because no one really knows for sure. I can envision families, you know, storing things away for the long winter ahead. I can see them getting their houses ready. I can see them gathering the firewood necessary to keep their fires going throughout the long winter. I can see them start to tell stories as Orion rises higher in the sky towards midnight. I can see them relate and pass on oral traditions of clan migrations over time in the canyon. I can see the education of the young ones continue. I can see the education of the medicinal societies that more than likely existed in Chaco Canyon continue. I can see them wrap up their crops and store away their seed sources for the next spring so that they can have a successful harvest a year from now. All of these things were undergoing in Chaco Canyon, and it's kind of comforting to think that not a lot has changed because a lot of the rural farmers in the United States today are doing the same sorts of things.
One of the elements that makes Chaco so fascinating is the artwork, particularly on the utensils, the cups in particular. This may have been a time when they spent a lot of time sitting around creating art.
Yes, definitely. I could easily see a group of potters gathering up their pottery and getting it ready to fire by slowly and methodically painting these paintings with nothing more than a yucca fiber brush and some hematite that is ground iron from the rocks, and then firing it in a nice kiln. They're very, very skilled in any craft they undertook here 1,000 years ago. And we look back and think, wow, they were doing this with rocks. They were doing this with their hands. They were doing this with the plants. And it really puts it into perspective.
One of the things that fascinates me, I spent extended time in Mesa Verde, where they have an extraordinary collection. And I'm not familiar with the actual collection that you have at Chaco, but I do know that when a person gets into really has an opportunity to see the extent of the artifacts, that you realize that these people had an enormous variety of tools and creations, clothing elements, mats, all sorts of things. And that leads me to always encourage people to try to expand their thinking. So oftentimes when people think of Southwestern cultures, Native American cultures, and I mean this respectfully,
but people tend to think of them as little brown-skinned people in loincloths. These were not little brown-skinned people in loincloths. Just as any other culture, and this was truly, as you say, a metropolis, there were an enormous amount of things that were required for those people to survive. And I encourage people when they visit Chaco, for example, to really take a look and try to imagine all of the tools. Tell me about your opportunity to kind of see the collections. I haven't seen the collections at Chaco. What do you find?
Well, the collections are huge and massive. We have over a couple million artifacts in curation right now, and they range from wood beams that are useful for gathering dates from the sites to bone tools that were used for poking holes in leather or buckskin of elk or deer. And you see everything from bracelets and artwork and macaws to copper bells. So you have the entire gamut of tools necessary for everyday living to some really special things that you don't find anywhere else other than Chaco. You find painted boards. You find all kinds of things, all of which can, a portion of which, I should say, can be seen on the Internet today through the Chaco's webpage.
Oh, well, let's talk about that.
You can access Chaco's webpage at www.nps.gov/CHCU, Chaco Culture National Historical Park.
Well, I'm going to spend some real time there because the Chaco culture fascinates me. I'm sure it will fascinate anybody. I guarantee it will fascinate anybody. If it doesn't, I don't know where you've been all your life. It's well worth a visit. We've been talking with Brad Shattuck, who's the Chief of Natural Resources at Chaco Culture National Historical Park. Brad, I want to thank you for adding your voice to the Wild Side News.
My pleasure. Great honor to be here.
Take time to sense the wonder of the natural world and the intelligence, creativity, and strength of the natural systems. Stay with us now after a short break to learn how your creativity may just help to save the world and put a big check in your bank when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
It's amazing, really, how many songs we actually know. Hear a favorite tune on the radio, and the next thing you know, you're tapping your foot, mouthing the words, and maybe even laying down your own rendition. Songs are masters of change. We'll take a short break, and while we do, I want you to think about three songs you think brought about the most significant changes. Songs of protest, songs of struggle, songs of joy and inspiration. When we return, you'll find out how music is going to help re-energize the world when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News. Energy independence. Lots of people are talking about it as the specter of what the new energy wars really could mean. As the world develops, as China takes their profits and buys up the world's resources, energy independence becomes ever more important. www.ei2025.org, which stands for Energy Independence by 2025, is serious and applying some truly creative strategies to get this message out to the mainstream. Listen up, because today we help launch a contest to write, record, and promote our new energy anthem, be it rock, folk, reggae, rap, or grunge, makes no difference as long as it sounds the call. And for the musician or band that wins, it's a $3,000 prize and all the trappings.
Chris, I want to welcome you to Wildside News. Thanks for being here.
Sydney, it's a great opportunity. I appreciate you having me on your show.
Well, listen, you come from a rather unique background. You've been very successful in the corporate world, and recently you've made a change to really redirect your future to deal with America's future, specifically the energy future. Tell us how this came about.
Well, about a year and a half ago, my nephew was being sent to Iraq for the second time, and I'm kind of a student of history, and so just got done reading a book called A Peace to End All Peace, and basically talking about the Middle East. And when you read that book and you put, you know, Iraq and the whole Middle East in historical perspective, and also our dependency on that region itself, it all of a sudden became clear. It was like an epiphany to me that said, boy, we need to make the Middle East strategically irrelevant. In other words, why do we even care? And the only reason we care is for the oil. The nation itself, I mean, our nation and the world, we move from the Industrial Revolution, the Industrial Age, to the Information Age. And now we're moving into what I classify as the Energy Age. The countries of the future that will survive and prosper are those that have control over their own energy. And that's one aspect of our economy that we can no longer outsource. I mean, currently we're about 70% of our energy needs are outsourced, which puts us in a very precarious situation.
And so if we were to continue, which it seems at this point we are, because there don't seem to be that many effective means to fund and provide alternative sources of energy, what do you see our future looking like?
Actually, there's the more you research, and again, like I said earlier, about a year and a half ago, I really started to delve into this topic and doing the research. There's a couple of reports out. One is for the World Energy Outlook. It was published in 2004, and basically this is a report that comes out from the International Energy Agency, and they say that there are enough of reserves and production, or there will be enough reserves and production in place to last the world to 2030. That's if there's social stability, enough economic investment is made to bring oil, you know, the tar sands in Canada and Venezuela, et cetera, to market. So there's a lot of caveats on that. So if you assume anything goes wrong, and that's actually what they say in the report, you know, if anything goes wrong, there won't be enough supply to meet demand through 2030. Another data point is Dick Cheney back in 1999 basically stated by the year 2010, the world would need an additional 50 million barrels per day. That's only, you know, 5 years off, and right now the U.S. uses 20 million barrels a day. So to put that in context, you know, we need to almost double our production within the next 5 years, which is not going to happen. I mean, matter of fact, for every 2 barrels of oil we use today, we find one. So you can just see, you know, we're going on a downslope. We're not going on an increased slope of production.
There aren't any new grand reserves that seem to be on the horizon.
That's exactly the point, is all proven reserves, and again, based on how much you can actually get out of those reserves and the cost of doing so, that's all factored into that World Energy Outlook. So it's saying that spending enough time, money, and energy, we only have enough right now to last to 2030. So, you know, there is a finite endpoint there that we're going to have to think about, okay, how can we extend that, you know, to meet our energy requirements? You mentioned during the intro about China and India and their demands. I mean, China's demand year over year in March of this year was up 23% over the prior year. And that's just, you know, if you look at the curve, I mean, it's going to be a hockey stick here. China is expected to actually sell more cars in a year in the next 5 years than the United States. And we sell about 16 million cars a year.
It becomes a formidable challenge, to say the least. And then there's another issue to this as well that I think people sort of don't talk about but really must. Some people are saying, why in the world are we burning oil? It's far too precious, because our entire economy, for other forms other than just energy, require oil. We use it in almost everything we manufacture, in plastics and lubricants and fertilizers and things. We have to realize that we have a limited reserve of this, and it's a precious resource that is necessary for our full spectrum of economic expression to maintain.
what's really interesting about what you're saying is there's one factoid that I tell people and they're kind of amazed. It takes 90 barrels of oil to produce a car, approximately. It doesn't matter what car. It could be a hybrid. It could be the Hummer. Obviously, a little bit more for the Hummer. But 90 barrels per car. If we purchase 16 million cars a year, you're talking, you know, 100 million barrels of oil just to produce the cars
mm-hmm.
that then consume more oil.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it is kind of an exponential type of problem. You know, getting back to China and its expansive growth in moving to automobiles, you can just tell that we're going to be in a situation where oil is going to be far more rare to find, and it's going to be far more costly to get out of the ground, and then it's going to be far more costly to get it into your tank. So, again, just from an economic perspective, if you were a conservative, you'd be concerned. I mean, right now, $200 billion a year is spent on foreign oil. I mean, that's the largest component of our trade deficit.
So let's talk about how do we get from here to a better place, because that's really what you're focused on. You're very, very committed to this, and that's where EI2025.org is putting all of its attention. EI is Energy Independence 2025. Define for us better what that really means to you.
If you look at all the statistics, and we kind of looked over the years of things like miles per gallon, fuel efficiency, everything happens like in 20-year cycles or 10-year cycles. To build new refining facilities, to build new biodiesel plants, anything of a magnitude that we're talking about takes 5-10 years to build. You know, hydrogen, you know, talk about the hydrogen economy, that's, you know, bleeding edge right now. It's not ready for prime time. That's a 15-year horizon type of issue. So right now the Department of Energy does its planning based on political every 4 years. You know, the Department of Energy is a political appointee. What we need to do is revamp the Department of Energy and have them focused like on the next Manhattan Project, the next Apollo mission. And there's others out there espousing this too. It's like we need to get this country dedicated to the pursuit of energy independence to get us ready for the next energy age. And we need to do that now, and it's going to take 20 years. And that's a realistic time frame, you know, based on the given state of innovation and technology and how fast you can bring these things online.
Well, of course, the operative word there is we. We must. And that's also a direct part of why you've organized EI 2025, and that is really to bring this message to the public, to begin to craft and create the body politic to address these issues, and you're actually doing it in a number of very interesting ways. Let's start out, we're going to talk about your song contest in just a moment here, but let's talk about your website and some of the interesting advertisements and approaches that you've utilized to help bring this message forward.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity to tell your listeners about it. It's our website, and that's EI2025.org, is geared toward a national petition. And just if your listeners you know, care about energy independence and could help us with this cause, much appreciate their going out there and signing up on our petition. A lot of information out there, so what we try and do is get the most recent information about oil prices and facts and get them out on that website. But our mission is really to communicate to the American public this need for energy independence. If you think about all the other organizations that are out there, and there's a lot of good ones, they're not taking the message to the American public. If you think about things that have changed our culture over time, Smokey the Bear, you know, only you can prevent forest fires, littering, you know, how many times were we, you know, pounded in our heads during the 70s, you know, don't, you know, stop littering. Smoking, you know, anti-smoking campaigns. Those things take many years to change a culture, and that's what we're trying to do, is let's get that message out through radio, and basically through mass media, right? You know, radio, TV, billboards, and we've done all those things. We haven't done TV as of yet because of the cost. And we're finding out that people like hearing about it. You know, they like to know that somebody cares, and that's what we're all about. If they come to our website, sign up, and then they end up going to these other sites that are trying to make a difference, that's great, you know. But our mission is to get people engaged, because people need to know that as a consumer and as a voter, they can make a difference. And that's kind of what our message is all about. You know, stand up and help us make a difference.
What do you think I know you've been involved, as you say, at the corporate level, so marketing is a huge part of every decision. And I'm just curious, a smart guy like you, and you are, what do you find to be those key marketing points that seem to resonate with the American public and get them to, one, wake up, two, pay attention, and then actually, three, do something about it?
That's always, you know, that secret sauce in marketing. You know, we're trying a bunch of different, almost like guerrilla marketing at this point in time to see what resonates. And what has been resonating, and people have gotten back to me on this, is, you know, we say in our radio advertisements, let's make the Middle East strategically irrelevant. And, all, you know, that just lights people up. It's like, yeah, why do we care? You know, I mean, you think about it as, you know, if we as a country, whether you're conservative or a liberal or whatever, if we want to have a moral compass, if we want to stand on moral high ground, you know, let's stand for, you know, let's get involved in world politics at a level of where we can really make a difference, not because of just economic gain on our part, you know, not just because we need them for oil. And what we need to do is, you know, it's almost like we're addicted, you know, and as an addict, you know, we're making very stupid mistakes, stupid decisions at the global economic level. I mean, you know, we're backing up bad regimes. You know, you talk about trying to be an example for future generations, and that's what we're talking about, is let's change our culture to where we don't need to care about them for oil, for something that we need. And that's going to be hard to do, but I think some of those messages are resonating, and people are saying, hey, I can make a difference.
Jim Woolsey, who is a past director of the CIA, has suggested that energy is a national security issue, that it rises to that status. Now, in terms of national security, I suppose there's two ways to go about this. One is to become ever more powerful and prove it and get what you need. Another may be through more diplomatic and creative ways, and I think perhaps that's the path that you're really trying to encourage.
Exactly. You know, the thing is, if you believe that we're going to move into what's called an energy age, where, you know, the countries that have control over their own energy requirements, they have enough energy to meet their economic growth, and they control their own destiny. I mean, I firmly believe we're entering that new age. If you don't believe that, then it's fine. Globalization is globalization, and you would import energy from the cheapest place you could possibly get it. The problem with that, and McNamara and others are saying this, is that you're going to become so reliant that all it takes is a hiccup in relationships, you know, which obviously we haven't been that good at on a global scale, to impact your entire economy. And we've already seen that back in the 70s when OPEC basically did the embargo. You know, we've already seen it. You know, so it's one of those things that history is a great teacher if you learn. You know, it's like, do we really want to be that dependent? Right now, 70% of our oil is imported, our energy needs.
We've reached a point where we almost have no choice but to become intelligent, use our intelligence, and create our way out of this. Before we talk about your song, which I think is a very creative way to get people interested and spread this message, talk to me and the audience here about what would you see the strategy to be to... what are some of the most important things we should be thinking about now? What are some benchmarks that we should be shooting for?
What's really interesting about that question is we've just recently contracted with UC Berkeley. They have a renewable and appropriate energy laboratory. It's headed up by Daniel Kamen. He's an expert in the field of renewable energies as well as appropriate energies. We've just contracted with them to do a six-month study to come up with a 20-year roadmap to energy independence. They're working on that as of today. We have a 20-year roadmap out on our website that's a draft. You know, people can go out there and, you know, look at it. They can give us comments on it. But our goal is to get a published plan that says it is achievable, and here's the economic issues, the scientific issues, and the social issues associated with it. And we're going to make it public. You know, we're going to, you know, basically release it to the press as well as send it to every congressional representative. And that's due out in January.
Fabulous.
So just our mission is, you know, the more you research into this, you know it's doable. You know, if you saw the email threads and the forums on our website, the technology is there. What's not there is the political will to do it. You know, go up against the status quo. You know, big oil and the energy bill that just went through Congress is a great example of that. The energy industry spent $350 million to get that bill passed, and they got an $11 billion payback for it.
It's a good investment.
It's a good investment. It didn't help us out any. You know, it didn't ease our energy dependence at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so again, it's just one of those things that we need to get ahead of this and say our goal is energy independence, and what will happen is industry will line up behind that.
Give us three first steps. I think sometimes that you have to start with one step. Let's talk about one step, two step, three step.
Well, I think the first step is we have to have somebody in charge. You know, we just saw this down in FEMA's reaction to New Orleans and whatever. It's somebody has to be in charge and responsible. And the Department of Energy is a great, it's like that could be the next NASA. So, but that's not their mission right now. You know, that's not the way they're put together. So we need to revamp the Department of Energy. And instead of a political appointee every 4 years, it needs to have, you know, basically an administrative head that can stand the test of time. You know, so Department of Energy revamping is number one. Number two is we have to get more of these messages out to the American public. So there needs to be an ongoing campaign to convince Americans that conservation, that energy independence is important and what the impacts of our economy are. So it's communication is step two. And number three, you know, it's interesting is we have to get industry behind us. And Bill Ford Jr. basically, I don't know if you just saw him, he came out recently asking for an energy summit.
Right.
And the reason behind that is the automobile makers, and actually Chevron right now is really interesting, is running full page ads in the LA Times concerning energy independence and about our dwindling supplies and capability with energy. So you have industry right now, pockets of industry, calling on leadership, you know, needing leadership and a compass today. So revamp the DOE, step one. Step two, start communicating to the public. And step three, let's get, you know, set some timelines, set some goals, and then get industry behind it. Because you're already seeing that industry will get behind it. They just want to know it's safe to do it.
Some people have talked about how much hard work all of this is, and quite honestly, that's one way to look at it. But also, it's possible to have a lot of fun, and that's actually where I come from. I really believe that if we could turn this process of becoming energy independent into almost a celebration of who we are and our the legacy of America, embracing our creativity, putting people back to work, rebuilding our economy, and creating energy independence, and have a good time. And that's what brings us to this next thing, because I think perhaps you share that. You like to have a good time as well, and so you've created a rather unique opportunity and contest to help bring this message forward, and my hat's off to you for it.
Oh, you're talking about our song contest.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, we just launched that. Actually, press release either went out today or it's going to go out tomorrow. It's a nationwide song contest. We're actually... You know, any of your listeners that are out there, if they could get on our website, there's a way to actually, you know, the entry forms are out there, the rules and the guidelines are out there. The winner, which will be announced on March 31st, so that's a little ways away, 2006, will earn $3,000 cash prize. Over $7,000 in total will be awarded. Songs can be submitted between now and January 31st. And as soon as the songs get submitted and reviewed for posting, online listeners can actually go out and start rating and ranking them, you know, basically telling us if they like them or not.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, so I think the goal here is for us to get a theme song. You know, if you want to be the next Francis Scott Key, we're talking an energy independence, Declaration of Independence here. So, you know, put some words down to music. Get your garage band together. Get your old guitar out of the closet, and you know, see what you can do for us.
Well, now can Bruce Springsteen try too?
Anybody, it's open to anybody, and we'd love to have as many people as possible out there, because I think what this will do is, as the musicians get involved, you know, then their friends will get involved, because they, you know, obviously for voting, and it's just an awareness campaign. I think you get a twofer, maybe even a threefer out of this. A twofer is when you get more than one thing, you know, when you try something. We're going to get a song out of it. We're going to get exposure, and the musicians are going to have fun doing this, and you know, hopefully get some promotion of their own songs.
Well, I'll tell you what, music is a change agent, and it has certainly in the past demonstrated that through time, all the time, and I think it's a brilliant idea myself. So you get this song, someone's going to announce the winner and receive, the first prize is $3,000, and second prize is $1,000, and then third prize is four $500 prizes. What do you hope to happen with your song?
Well, we want to give the band as much exposure as possible, and so what we're looking for is, you know, can we use that song in some of our advertising that we're doing, our media blitz? Again, you know, just so you know, this contest is just the beginning. We're going to have a video contest to follow this up. We're going to have an artwork contest to follow this up. You know, the way we've architected the system is to enable us to allow contest after contest. You know, the goal here is, you know, let's get Americans engaged. I like what you said earlier, creativity. You know, this whole issue, energy independence, is about innovation and creativity. And that's what's great about music and a lot of the arts. You know, it's like, you know, the arts are creative. Let's kind of blend that right into, you know, what a lot of people classify as very technical. And I think we can create something even better out of both.
This is funny. As I'm sitting here, my foot is tapping. My body's already moving. I can feel the energy already. Now, of course, a great place for this to be spread, obviously, would be in the college campuses. So why don't you put out a call for, in particular, kids in college to ramp this up? They got their iPods, they can spread this. I mean, what's fun about this is right now it's possible to spread this around the world so fast with the internet downloading and blogs, etc. Go ahead, I'm going to let you go ahead and pitch this.
Well, I think you're doing a great job selling it, and I just make sure everyone knows to get the song contest info, they go to ei2025.org. Right on our front webpage, you'll see song contest, submit an entry, listen and vote. And now listen and vote won't be active until we have songs posted. Now, again, we just announced this yesterday, so it's the word's just now getting out. And it'll take a few months for people to write songs and you know, get them up online. Once the voting is all done, that's when the podcasting and all that comes into play, is we're going to let people come to our site and listen and vote, and then when everything is said and done, we're going to actually put a lot of these songs out on the podcast and make them available to everybody.
I want to take my hats off to you for taking that idea and pushing it out there into the planet here. You know, I think it's this type of creativity that can start to really inspire and spark the spirit that we need to make these changes. I personally think we need to change this from ominous to opportunistic. And Chris Wolf, I want to thank you for making this happen and sharing your will and goodwill on the Wild Side News here. Let's tell people again how they can visit your website.
That's www.ei2025.org. And Sydney, thank you very much for having me on your show, and I look forward to having your listeners come out on our site and hopefully give us some tunes.
Let's rock and roll.
All right.
We'll follow the story. Visit today's show page where you'll find links to the EI 2025 website and information on how to submit your energy anthem. Now that you have that pencil, keep it out, because when we come back, you'll use it to learn how to draw, yes you, the wonders of our fall leaves. So don't leave now. We'll be right back with your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's fall around the country. You can always feel it coming. The days turn softer. The winds dance a bit more briskly. The trees unveil their secrets hidden in the green, then toss them all away. So today, I'm giving you one of the most powerful clearings and connections. Every one of you know what the leaves mean. Now it's time to learn more of their secrets. You'll find out how when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News. I'm an artist. I teach people how to draw and paint. And I've heard so often, oh, I can't even draw a stick figure. Well, that was then, and this is now. I've already done three previous on-air art classes that you can listen to at your convenience and follow along on the special pages. I've taught you how to create a field sketchbook, how to do thumbnail sketches, how to draw plants, and now it's time to learn to draw leaves. And there's no better time than in the fall. There's more to this than art. It's really about taking time to take a special walk, a walk to look for colorful leaves. When you do, and I want each of you to do this, something ancient and powerful will begin to grow as those deep childhood memories return. Every child finds the fall-colored leaves that lay at our feet magical. We all need a little magic, and this is the easiest way to do it. I don't care if you're 6 or 26 or 56 or 90. I want you to listen, then at your convenience, through the archives and the special instruction page, take this 20-minute course. So, from today's show page for October 20th, look at segment 3 and mouse click on the Click Here big letters. Do that now. Okay, you should be on a special page on drawing fall leaves. To follow along, just listen and practice the simple steps following the illustrations and instruction that you'll hear. All you really need is a pencil or pen, so let's begin. The first law of nature is that every living thing is composed entirely of curves. Take two. The first law of nature is that every living thing is composed entirely of curves. That's what we refer to as organic. And beauty is in the form of youthful nature. And this union of curves and beauty is the secret to the wonder of all living things. So to draw anything in nature, you simply learn to draw curves. Today, we apply this to learning to draw leaves. And what's really easy is that there are only two kinds of curves to learn, inner curves and outer curves. Notice that I use I-C for inner curve and O-C for outer curve. Then some curves are short or tight, some kind of long, and some are very long. With that, you can draw nature. You'll notice a row of leaves preceded by an A. We start out by drawing from the picture of the yellow leaf. Notice that in the sketch, the left side of the leaf is a beautiful even curve. Drawing it is like drawing part of a circle. Then notice that the right side has both an inner curve and an outer curve. The inner curve is short. The outer curve is even and longer. Now draw the left and right sides. You can stop this instruction by hitting the pause button on your media player and then return by playing play. So drawing leaves is a matter of identifying the curves, inner and outer, short, medium, and long. Let's look at leaf B. To make things easier, you can start off by drawing the midrib of the leaf. It, too, will be a curve. It starts out as a medium curve from the stem, then becomes a long, even curve. Next, note that the left side is a very long outer curve. draw it so that it starts and finishes on the midrib like the leaf. Now, the right side has three curves. Nearest the stem, there is a short inner curve that changes in a long outer curve that changes into a long inner curve. Say it as you draw it, accentuating the long when appropriate. That helps you define the time and length. Now, let's look at Series C. Start with a midrib, then talk your way around the leaf, left side and right side. That'll take some time. When you're done, now on the right side, you'll notice an imperfection. Notice in the pencil sketch that I have not drawn that. That is how you should sketch, making the perfect leaf shape, because that's how nature wants it, than adding the imperfections. It's so much easier. Also, there is a little clock. I use that as a handy way of interpreting the angle of the small little veins that branch off of the midrib. I like to give it a time angle, like on a clock, because we all know how to interpret that. I call it in reference to the angle the hour hand would be corresponding to the vein. In this case, in Series C, the veins branch off at about a 1:15 o'clock angle. Now this is important because everything that branches in that species of plant, the trunk to the branch to the stem to the leaves to the midrib to the veins, is at that same angle. It's nature's way of making things easy. It's also one of the secrets to drawing the beauty of nature that often repeats and creates symmetry and rhythm. So the veins branch at that clock angle, but then they curve. Not all leaves are so simple. The red oak is more complex, as in the D series. But here again, start by envisioning the curved shape that forms around the leaf's edges. All leaves are made of these basic shapes. This is also a secret of drawing nature. Draw the basic shape, then draw the details to conform to that shape, and it will work much better every time, much better than if you try to just draw it on the fly, because you will create the beauty of the form of nature. Using the leaf form, you can then draw in the notches and the teeth, making sure that every edge is composed of different curved lines. You will begin to see how this works when you take a closer look. When you draw, you should make that guideline of the leaf shape light, then darken the final drawings as in the filled-in color. I did these from the drawings. One of the most wonderful fall leaves is the maple, but it is hard to draw until you use this method. You start off by drawing the basic leaf shape, using curving lines to form a smooth shape. Then analyze the midrib clock angles as I have in the second sketch. Then use those to finish the details. You notice that my original sketch was not correct, so I modified it in the final, then made and filled in the details. To finish off your drawings, it's often best to use a good black pen like the one shown above. You trace over your pencil sketch, being sure to connect all of the leaf's details using only beautifully curved lines. Try to make them smooth. If you do this, I guarantee you success. But what's more, I guarantee you time well invested in getting outdoors, walking and looking, being surprised with your discoveries, gathering some of the bounty, then looking and feeling and connecting with the absolute truth of life that exists in every single leaf on the planet. At some point, you may find yourself seeing the world differently, noticing the beauty all around, perhaps wanting to draw or paint it. I give you this gentle warning. If you aren't already drawing, you may find yourself getting hooked on learning how to improve. I can only hope that this little lesson may help you move in that direction. So now, do it. no matter how proud or busy or shy or lazy, before the fall leaves are turned to dust, get out, collect, follow this lesson, and learn to draw the fall leaves. You can revisit this lesson anytime, stopping it when needed, repeating as needed, as you can with any of the programs you find on the archives, which contain your private collection of Voices of the Earth, which speak to you each Thursday or whenever you want on the archives. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until next time, when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.